Hello, Tiffany. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are
Good.
you?
I'm all chilled. This
Oh.
is Tato from Stage Fright.
Hotatsu.
Yeah.
Hotatsu. Okay, I got it. All right.
I understand that you are running a Bitcoin exchange in Namibia.
A Bitcoin marketplace.
A
So
Bitcoin marketplace.
not yeah, we can't call it legally an exchange because that would put us in the same territory as money exchanges, which currently under recommendations from the Bank of Namibia, you're not allowed to operate as. So we don't facilitate exchanges. What we do, we're a market maker. We set a price for buy and sell. And so essentially, it is exchanging, but it's not an exchange as you would traditionally think of an exchange, Luno, Altcoin Trader, whatever.
Okay. Interesting. All right. I'd like to cover a few topics with you,
Yes.
with regards to Bitcoin and also the work that you guys do.
Okay.
And the first question, just to start things off, is how much Zimbabwean dollars would you like to have in your bank account?
None.
No, there's no amount of Zimbabwean dollars a person can offer you, and you'd be like, okay, cool.
maybe not the dollars, but the electronic credit that you can use to buy the bond notes, but not the
I.
notes themselves, no.
Okay.
Because at least that I can exchange into US or something else.
No. Okay. All right. So then let's get into Bitcoin as a form of currency. Like, when did you first hear about Bitcoin?
Must have been, I think, early or mid 2010. And I started, I think, I don't know, I don't remember where I read an article about, I think it was some computing magazine or some computing article. I read about it, and then I joined the Bitcoin forum in early 2011. And I read the white paper, didn't really understand it back then. Was out of my pay grade at that time. And but compute in terms of electronic money, that made sense to me. So I picked it up. I joined the forum. I asked some people for some Bitcoin to see how it worked. Somebody sent me, I think, a Bitcoin or something, and I invested that into some pyramid mining scheme, turned it into 19 Bitcoin, and then sold it all for like 200 bucks.
So you basically what people call a Bitcoin OG.
I don't like that term. I just I yeah, but yeah, I guess so. But yeah, I would yeah. I wouldn't call myself that because there's a lot of things I'm still learning about it now. So, but yeah, I mean, I started, yeah, around 2011, and yeah, interested. I mean, the interest was on and off. It wasn't like a consistent interest up to now. I've around, I think between 2014 and yeah, I think, maybe no 2012, maybe end of 2012, but my interest kind of waned and only picked back up at end of 2015, 16. So it hasn't always been a consistent journey.
Okay, so what is it that happened in 2015 to actually bring you back into it?
Well, price dynamics, obviously, I started rising in price, and I looked at it again after having not looked at it for about a year, and it interested me, why this thing is rising. I mean, I could understand electronic money. What I couldn't understand it at the time, I didn't have a good understand of the traditional monetary system either, but it's just seems strange to me that this thing created by a group of nerds is still running and continuously is running. So that that picked up my interest. I started looking into the technology. Obviously, at that time, the whole narrative was, I think, end of 2016, 2015, it was like blockchain, not Bitcoin. So I was also caught up in that, read about that a lot. Like, oh, okay, maybe it's not the technology. Maybe it's, I mean, maybe it's not the product itself. Maybe it's the technology behind it. And try to understand that also. And and until I looked into people who started writing about the economic theory of Bitcoin, it really didn't click.
Any articles you'd like to highlight that actually got you?
I think the first few articles weren't really articles, were the posts by Hal Finney on that somebody pointed me to on the Bitcoin forum. And that I didn't quite get what he was talking about in terms of how the theory of behind it. It's the first time when I read his article, the first time I started looking at Satoshi's posts also on the forum and his arguments on how growth around Bitcoin would happen and scarcity. And that interested me because also at the same time, around that time, I was also looking at the Zeitgeist documentaries. I don't know if you heard of those.
Anyone on the internet has seen a few Zeitgeist documentaries.
Yeah, and that introduced it to looking at economics from or at least monetary economics on how money was generated in a different light. And so something clicked there. And for another year or so, there wasn't really a lot of material from writers who were specific around looking at economic theory and Bitcoin. And then a lot of the stuff just popped up. Saifedean's book, the podcasts, and I picked that up. And once I got through the Bitcoin standards,
Hallelujah.
That's when everything sort of clicked. That was beginning 2018. That's when sort of everything kind of came together. And okay, maybe I should not only consider this as a technology, because that was what was always novel to me. I'm computer educate my education is in computer science and technology. So the technology had always been the novel aspect for me, and actually my second major was economics, which I didn't was really interested in until this point. So
And I'm specifically asking these questions because I also find it interesting that a person goes from hearing about Bitcoin to acquiring their first Bitcoin to there's always a next step to it. Your next step or a person's next step after acquiring the first Bitcoin is basically holding on to it or hodling. And then the next step is accumulating. And then the next step is migrating to, dump your whole national currency and just price everything in Bitcoin. Because, we have way too many incentives to do that these days. I also find it interesting, what type of things or what type of information actually pushes you to the next step? You hear about Bitcoin the first time, and you go on with your life, you read a few articles if you are able to grasp the technicalities of the articles, and then once somewhere down the line you acquire a Bitcoin, either from a friend or from an exchange. And here's another thing. Have you ever been paid in Bitcoin?
Well, I think so. I sometimes do music producing as my hobby, and I've lately been asking people to pay me in Bitcoin if they're gonna pay me well, if they're able to. But I also think, because back when I started and looking into Bitcoin in 2011, the whole narrative around what it was supposed to be used for was quite different than from what you hear today. A lot of the people who were early into it really looked at it as a peer. You know, also, you have to look at the time it was based in, when, you know, LimeWire, Kazaa, and Napster, and all of that stuff was really hot and still popping. And so it sort of took that kind of step. A lot of the people around it were, you know, people who didn't really understand the economics behind it, just that it's money on the internet. And okay, so if it's money on the internet, think of it like an internet technology. How do you enable it for internet? You know, so you had a lot of these eBay type of sites, sites where you could basically do gig type of work and get paid in Bitcoin, and small Bitcoin marketplaces. They were quite more frequent back then than they are now. I mean, they didn't work. And a lot of your money got stolen because a lot of them were fraudulent. But the whole ethos around it was quite different, because I think a lot of the people around it didn't quite get what Satoshi was trying to do until later. And that you're very right in that there's so many different stages. I myself have gone through, you know, numerous different stages of how I interact with Bitcoin, and it's really interesting to see even new people how they get in and this the journey they take. So and different journeys. I mean, it means different things for a lot of different people when you're in different types of situations. So it is. It's for me right now, it's the single most interesting subject across any field of technology or economics. It's really, because it applies to so many different aspects of human life. So
can I ask then, what pushed you to start a Bitcoin marketplace?
I was thinking of, when I ended reading the Bitcoin Standard, already before the Bitcoin Standard, in my thinking around what I knew about monetary economics, is that this, whatever this is currently now, can't hold. It didn't seem like it would last for another 50 years. As I started understanding, just what derivatives are, what the Forex market was, the International Bank of Settlements, and all of these things. And I started looking at, and I started just the devaluation of gold. It's only like about 3-4 years ago that I found out money wasn't backed by anything. I grew up thinking, okay, it must have been backed by gold or some metal or something. And only then did I realize that the last nation to drop their peg to gold was actually Switzerland in 2005, and when that came together, I was like, no, this there must be something else. And after reading the Bitcoin Standard, I was thoroughly convinced that Bitcoin probably is the next standard for global monetary exchange. I didn't know. I have no idea how we're going to get there. Nobody's got a crystal ball, but I'm pretty set on the fact that because of how I've come to understand how the monetary playing field works, and with that, it's Bitcoin is the only thing that has no effective coach or sponsor and is the only objective player in the whole field, I was convinced that it's going to come to that.
Here's a question from what you're saying. A person is listening right now and they hear you say that you found out that all these other currencies aren't backed by anything, right? So yeah. What is it that gives Bitcoin value?
I may be simplifying things a bit, but mm-hmm. I guess it's the same thing that gives money value, and that is it's, I guess, a very psychological thing. And
mm-hmm.
from my own experience and how I've grown up and how I've been, I guess, psychologically conditioned to believe money is backed by some sort of economic good that mm-hmm. a country keeps, rather than a coercion of mm-hmm. sorts, which what I believe it is now. Yeah. I think that it's coercion that gives money its value. It's how much to even simplify that, it's how much military power you can bring to bear in the world that sets the tone, basically. Mm-hmm. But if you look at monetary economics or just the history of it, you can factually state that, okay, the US dollar is this strong because the US has this much gold or this many resources. It's really the sort of psychological play, that has been brought about by how history has been written, by how politics is carried out, and definitely by how military power is wielded, that sets the tone for how money is sort of valued. And Bitcoin for me is the first thing that you can freely choose to say, okay, I value this as a form, as a medium of a good, whatever money you think of, whether you think it's it's something that you use to exchange, whether you think it's something that you use to hold value, but it's the first thing that you can elect to freely say, okay, I put my value in this. And that is what I think gives Bitcoin value, rather than a coerced value of, oh, this is my passport, or my allegiance is to this, and so I have to use this. And you don't really have a choice about using your country's currency or mm-hmm. any currency if you're in sort of in business. There's a precedent set, and you have to follow that precedent. Mm-hmm. And Bitcoin is the first thing that helps you set your own precedent, I guess.
Then I have some other points, maybe some other things I'd also like to share. In my journey, I think the first time I heard about Bitcoin was in 2013 or 2012 in varsity. Some lecturer was giving a lecture, and he decided that this lecture is going to be entirely about Bitcoin. But he was speaking about it from what is being published, like the media reports about it, and then the technical reports about it, like, oh, this is the technology, blah, blah, this is what you can do with it, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. And then, Bitcoin has always been in the negative light for the longest period because of the marketplaces you've mentioned. The fraudulent activities that people usually use it for and stuff like that. So I think he was saying it's going to take a lot for it to overcome all of the negativity and for people to actually see it for what it actually is. And weird enough, that same year or the following year, I do some stuff on the internet and someone wants to pay me in Bitcoin. This is the first time I'm actually now in a first time someone is speaking directly to me about it. I think 2015 or 20 something like that, 2014.
Wow.
And I'm like, let me see. Do I take Bitcoin or do I tell this person to use PayPal like normal people? To this day, I'm regretting not taking the Bitcoin. now that I know all of that, I'm like, fuck, I'm a very stupid man. Like, I should have taken the Bitcoin. So over the years, it kind of lived my life. And then 2 years later, 2017, the Bitcoin rally happens. The price is just going crazy. And then I'm like, what the fuck is happening with this? And then I start looking at the value it has gained and the things in my life that I actually want to do. And I'm like, that Bitcoin would have come in very handy had I just taken it and let it sit there. I start my journey. I'm like, okay, cool. It's time for me to really understand what is going on. How does this shit even work? And as you're saying, all these podcasts come out, all this literature comes out, I didn't read the white paper. I just read some explainers explain Bitcoin like I'm five. I really enjoyed that article, and some YouTube videos, and then I get to the Bitcoin standard. And lucky for me, I had like a 40-minute commute to work, and so I decided to listen to audiobooks on the commute. And as a consequence, I was like, I need to fit in more time. So I started walking an hour per day to just listen more to an audiobook. And then it became 2 hours commuting to work just to fit in more content. And then I read the Bitcoin standard and then I'm like, shit. Because the craziest thing with the Bitcoin standard that most people who haven't read it probably won't understand is that half of the book isn't even talking about Bitcoin. Half of the book is just talking about the history of money, what makes good money, and why other money is got placed by newer forms of money.
It's amazing.
And just reading that, I realized something else, right? And basically the relationship we have had as Africans with money. And I think it's part of the reason why you have believed that money is kind of backed by something. And I think it's the reality for most Africans because that's how we were brought up. And the reason is, as Africans who went through many years of colonization, we have never really chosen a currency for ourselves. We were told, as you said, we were forced to use whatever currency was dictated by whoever had the most force. And in this case, whichever colonizer colonized your country then said, okay, this is a currency that you guys are going to use from this point forward. Then I also found it interesting that if we rewind, the last time we probably chose a currency for ourselves as Africans is probably back when we still use cattle. To handle our transactions and stuff like that. And we technically didn't have a need for other forms of currency because, everyone was living in the same big old village and we will all share the harvest with the king and whatever distribute to those blah, 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 depending on what type of a village or culture you grew up in. That was sort of the reality.
Yeah. Now, but I mean, you're still right that cattle, even in that setting, would have been a universal currency pretty much anywhere across the continent, regardless even of cultural situation. So I'd agree there.
Yeah. So now fast forward, we're getting colonized. The colonizers bringing coins and they're like, okay, but before the coins, they bring the trinkets. In South Africa, a lot of people say we traded land for mirrors and spoons and stuff like that, right? Because those were scarce things to us at the time. And then they traded notes and they traded coins, and then they introduced us to currency and blah, 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 or their currency, let me just say that. And we were kind of forced to use it if we wanted to transact in their economy that was developed around the whole colonization procedures and blah, blah, blah. And now I'm like, we were told there was gold in the coins, right? And I even looked it up, like there was a certain amount of gold in South African rands. And as time went on, it became lesser and lesser. And as time went on, it was even replaced by other natural resources like copper and stuff like that. And obviously, paper money is the base now. So you don't even have to put anything precious in the coin anymore, or in the note. You just put the stamp and you say this is the value that the money holds. Yeah. And yeah, and as you say, Bitcoin is basically the first currency in a long time where we are in a position to volunteer, blah, blah, my English bundles are low.
No worries.
Accepted as a form of currency, you know, where no one else is forcing us to use that. And for me, after reading the Bitcoin Standard, I was like, okay, there's a lot of potential here. And we can actually, the possibilities are unlimited if you also look at what currencies have allowed people to do, what type of economies people have developed if they own their own currency. And that's when I read Human Action by Ludwig von Mises.
Yes.
And that book opened my eyes to so much economics, man. I was like, oh, so demand and supply is the basis, basically, of any currency. Like, and going back to the start of this conversation, asked you, how many Zimbabwean dollars would you like in your possession? And you were like, none, right? And that automatically translates to the value of the Zimbabwean dollar. Like, you would have to be given so much Zimbabwean dollars, but as you said, you wouldn't want them in physical form because where are you going to store all of these paper? So you would rather get them in electronic form. That's when we'll start considering having it in your name. And the other sad thing is if you hold on to them too long, they will probably lose their value. And in human action, that's
the reality of every money.
That
is the 100% reality of all. And that's fascinating how many people don't get that. They don't they don't understand that their money is literally losing value every single day. And there's been nothing that has reversed the trend for a very long time except for Bitcoin.
You know something interesting, though? I think people know that their money is losing value, right? But there is some phenomenon that makes them okay with that reality.
No, there is. I mean, there is definitely, you can't discount what globalization and more efficient industrial processes have done for lowering entry barrier to things that we, you know, a lot of people deem smartphones, computing, internet. It's funny that it's those things that have though gotten cheaper, and maybe that's like the psychological thing that you're talking about. But at the same time, the things that you actually need to live haven't gotten cheaper. That's the weird thing. It's, you know, the outliers in economy that have gotten cheaper, not healthcare, not housing, not education, or the right kind of education. None of those things. And yeah, that I guess the dichotomy between, oh, I can have a smartphone, but But you know, I'm in poverty, or I don't have medical aid, or those, maybe that sort of schism creates I don't know. something that you can live with, I don't know.
Yeah, I can even go as far as saying even the things that we believe have gotten cheaper, like the smartphones and all these things, have really not gotten cheaper. Okay. And I'm making this argument because I bought i5 laptop in like 2012 for like 5,000-6,000 rand.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how much an i5 laptop costs today?
Yeah. There is.
And at the same time, I'm like, we all know that it has gotten cheaper to make i5 laptops because Moore's Law, blah, 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 all these.
Yeah.
But if we are going spec for spec, right, it's harder to get something, or it's more expensive to get something 5 years down the line than it is. But the issue is a new standard gets, introduced. i3s perform quicker than i5s. Having an i3 now, running Windows 10 and so on and so forth, someone who has that setup would probably have a quicker laptop than the type of laptop I had back then, because also the software has improved. So in our minds, it's much cheaper to have a usable laptop, even though if you're going hardware to hardware and looking at all the physical parts that went into the thing, it shouldn't be that expensive as it is today.
I agree. Let
me get back from my tangent and go back to talking to you about your journey. What do you think the future of Bitcoin is?
I'd have to stake. I'm fully invested. I mean, I'm fully invested at this point in believing not only in terms of in terms of it makes up now 50%. It takes up 50% of all my time. Mm-hmm. I run another company, a software development company, where I do some other projects, but right now Bitcoin, I'm running the trading website, the marketplace is taking up about 60% of my day every single day. I'm definitely more focused on it, and even in terms of my expenses, how I live, how I make my money, where I invest my money, I'm really invested into Bitcoin at this point. So I would say I believe it's going to be the global monetary standard of some sort, whether it's not for government exchange, of large settlements between governments, whether it's for saving, whether it's for exchange of goods. It's going to be, I see it heading as becoming a standard for all of these things. Maybe not all of those things at the same time, but... Mm-hmm. The same way I see my journey and sort of it. Okay, first it was the internet money, then it was okay, this is actually real money when you start to understand what money is, and then okay, this is probably going to be the global monetary standard. I think in the same sort of way I had that journey, it's going to Pac-Man eat up the global economy. That's what I think. I think it's pretty much what we've seen over the past 10 years, and very much so this year. I think even just the last month in how it's performed has proven its robustness and it's working for its intended purpose. Mm-hmm. Obviously, nobody can tell the future, and it could go to zero tomorrow, but I'll take those chances against what we've seen I mean, look at oil. I'll take those chances, yeah.
Okay, so what would need to happen to stop it from becoming a global monetary asset?
I think there's two things for me that can stop it. It's mm-hmm. either governments get really concerted
mm-hmm.
and put up a concerted effort to, I guess, round up people who use it, because that would probably be the only way they could do it now.
Okay.
I think, yeah, that or concerted attacks on its network, which I have less and less faith of as I see government's response to this global pandemic. But mm-hmm. I can't discount the state's power and the state's access to resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would, if there was really a no holds barred, and I'm talking no holds, so they didn't care about human rights, and it's, which probably they already don't, but I mean, if they blatantly don't care and round up and shoot people who are part of the network, yeah, that maybe mm-hmm. would have. The second thing would be that people just don't, the network loses its robustness because there isn't interest or there isn't a strong, how would you say, I guess, intellectual interest in actually figuring out how this technology would work in society, and that mm. people just see it as a money and don't see it as something that needs to be protected in the way that it is today with running nodes and all. Well, you know, for the listener who doesn't know about those things, basically to keep the network robust, to make sure that the hardware that is needed to make sure that Bitcoin works, if people just forget about that, you know, and just see it as a money, then it's easy for somebody, again, like a government or a party with nefarious or an ulterior motive to take control of the network and co-opt it for their own purposes. So those are the two things I think that could stop it. Other than that, I don't think anything else can stop it at this point. I think there's too much inertia behind it at this point to not get where it's going, which again, I don't know if that is it, but that's my feeling.
I find your first point interesting, because the whole government should actually go all out and try to keep people from using Bitcoin narrative. I find that interesting because I was listening to Kendrick Lamar's album last night.
Mm-hmm.
And on Money Trees, he has the line, "Everybody's gonna respect the shooter, but the one in front of the gun lives forever." And I see any government that first attempts to, you know, keep people from using Bitcoin will generally give it that effect, where I think they call it the Barbara Streisand effect, by the fact of you trying to keep people from using this. Even a person who was not interested in using the currency is going to be like, why do you not want me to use this thing? What is it that you are so scared of that I should actually know about and I should actually use? And I think, I'm sorry to say this, but the sooner governments attempt to shut Bitcoin usage down, the better. The sooner they do it, speed up. Tell your government to stop people from using Bitcoin today, because that will make international news. And, you know, The aftermath of that is actually what gets people to start using Bitcoin. And
well, as we've seen with countries that have tried to ban usage. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But and I think that the caveat to that, though, is that governments have the ability to I can't discount what you're saying. Mm-hmm. That's very true. At the same time, government can criminalize. Mm-hmm. They've got the power to criminalize usage, and I'm pretty sure, you know, there's some pretty nifty legal arguments you could make, mm-hmm. you know, for that. And I think in terms of your ethics and morality, people will tend to fall in line with what law dictates because they see it as the right thing. The individual person doesn't have the right to do that or the ability to do that. So I get the martyr effect of putting, but then again, you know, you look at democracy in China or this supposed squashing of democracy in China or whatever political movement that has been suppressed in any country. Anywhere effectively by just taking out the people who did it. And at the same point, it's kind of a political statement you're making when you choose to elect to use Bitcoin. And as I said, if it was no holds barred, they're backed against the corner. And we have to save state money by using force, bombing houses that hold nodes, and shooting people who talk anything or have been associated to Bitcoin, the blockchain is public, on site.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what? you could. I guess you could suppress that martyr effect for a good number of years before people start thinking to pick it up again. So maybe you wouldn't fully kill it, but I think you could discourage greatly.
But only for your local part of the world.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah,
everyone else is like, those guys right there are messing up. And I think the other thing Bitcoin has is the whole privacy technology or the whole privacy argument behind it. Where a lot of people are trying to use it more privately, CoinJoins and the Tor network and all these things that make it harder for anyone to validate whether or not you actually are, one, running a Bitcoin node or receiving Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And, it's becoming a running joke to say I lost my keys in a boating accident. Because no one can either validate or deny the fact that you lost your keys in a boating accident. And everyone needs to plan a boating trip anytime in the near future, just for their own safety, if they know that they have basically put themselves out there as once upon a time receiving Bitcoin. But I think your other point is what I believe is something that might kill Bitcoin eventually, which is where we don't have enough intellectual people looking at it from a technical level. Let me not even say intellectual people. Not enough people using Bitcoin who are actually interested in the technicalities of the thing.
Yeah.
Right?
That's I think even more. Mm-hmm. It's more threats than scenario. But again, it goes to what you're saying that there's so much that hinges on. Figuring out new ways to translate aspects of the technology which aren't necessarily technical for people to use, because you know there's a journey you're going to get if you're an end user who's you're not educated in computing. To get from even hearing about Bitcoin to get to full node, to hear knowing what a full node is, is quite a step, even if you're in a developed country. I mean, you see it with Twitter journeys and even, you know, some of the prominent people in the Bitcoin media space, and how even they, you know, are disconnected from the reality of okay, Bitcoin is something that you can send to as money, to okay, Bitcoin actually has this other technological aspect behind it that if you want to help it actually grow, you need to know about that. So it scares me, because even my reaction when someone asks me to help them with their computer is not the greatest always. I assume people should know how to use things, and I tend to get annoyed quickly when somebody doesn't know. I'm not the best explainer over a long term period, because I'll get annoyed. And I see the same sort of thing when I see how people ask on Reddit forums and Twitter. I see the same sort of attitude from a lot of technology people. Not always. I mean, there's a lot of great resources out there that simplify a lot of this complex information. But again, it is very complex information. It's really, really complex. I mean, I think it's more complex than a lot of the stuff I looked at in uni. And to expect now a layman to go from, okay, this is Bitcoin money, I can send like email, to all of this stuff we're talking about, even is quite a step. It's quite a leap, and that's what gives me scares me about the thing we're talking about, that if this thing goes so large and the information doesn't grow in the or the interest in the information doesn't grow in the same proportion, that could become a danger.
So how would you say we should approach introducing our parents, our uncles and aunts to the world of Bitcoin?
I'm not sure. I don't know. my best answer would be that I don't know. But if I'd had to spend a second thinking about that, I would say, given my own journey, that what got me interested was, you know, holding it, losing a lot of it, and then acquiring it and losing it again. But that process of getting to value it gave me the interest in it, to look into it further. I think that would be true regardless of whether you're interested in computing or not. So I think more than educating resources around it is more how usability, probably, that the UX around or usability technology around it gets better, because that will drive, once people start using it and you use it and you value, okay, what is this technology? Why people will tend to ask why when they have it. And so I think that's probably the most important thing, rather than figuring out how educational materials can be developed in the right way for a certain subsection of a population, because people will elect how they learn something in any case, regardless. So, and I think once you have that interest, you know, it's hard to stop a person from you know, not finding some resources and getting those resources. But the most important thing would probably be having people use it first.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, people who the majority of people, you know, won't listen to or a book or read a book on something they're just not interested in. They've never used.
Okay.
They see in passing. And it's kind of what I see also as I, from the business. People okay. will buy first and then get interested, start yeah. asking questions. The mm-hmm. ones who usually start asking questions before they buy end up not buying. So,
So then do you have any price predictions?
No.
Come on.
Well, I'd say my prediction is that I don't think we've whatever the current rally is mm-hmm. that's happening is nice. I think it's a panic. Well, not panic, but obviously a lot of people are trying to find something that looks positive. If especially if you're not a qualified investor who looks at, you know, long-term history of stocks and invests by actual technical analysis, you're just looking for something that's been green throughout mm-hmm. this bloodbath over the last 2 months. And I think that's what's driven a lot of people into Bitcoin over the last month. But I don't think we've seen the worst of what the coronavirus pandemic has brought to bear on the global economy. So mm-hmm. I think when that happens, Bitcoin will probably also tank with it. Mm-hmm. Price will probably, if I had to make a prediction, I'd say maybe even as low as 2,500 back.
Okay.
Lower. The time when yeah, so like the hens come home to roost on the global economy. And then from there, from that time, whenever that, I think that will probably be, given the stresses the pandemic is having on the global economy, probably within the next 2 years or so. And then once that happens, I think from there we will start to see really what Bitcoin is really priced at. I don't really think we know what it's really priced at, because I mean the stock market is crazy. You've got companies that are literally have laid off, you know, more than half of their workforce, half of their economic output has been slashed, you know, for the next foreseeable future, but they're gaining stock market value. There's the market is making no sense right now. It's so I don't think Bitcoin is valued correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, maybe, I don't know, 100,000 per coin, 1 million per coin is, I don't think it's far-fetched. After seeing what oil has done, I really don't think
that's
far-fetched anymore.
So but, how are you going to prepare for the $2,500 per coin incident?
By buying more every day.
Preach. Okay, cool. I think I've covered most of the questions I had. Well, technically, as you say, there's always something to talk about in Bitcoin, like part of the reason you spend 50% of your time on it is really so much to talk about. Lightning Network. The research that is being done on it, whether or not governments can actually adopt it as a reserve currency, what does that look like?
That's a really interesting aspect of it.
Like, how do you use Bitcoin securely and privately, and all of these different things. So, yeah, time is still an issue, though. So I'll probably talk to you again on some of these topics. And I don't know if you have any questions you want to ask me.
Actually, it would be off on a little tangent since I've seen some of your Twitter posts. I actually wanted to ask, what is Polelo, the site that you're actually doing the podcast for?
So Polelo is the podcasting platform, basically, and I'm working on it. And this podcast is called Stage Fright, and the podcast specifically is talking about the shifting platforms from the physical realm to the digital realm. I mostly focus on art because that's where the stage bit is. Oh, and I forgot to ask you about fears, actually, but Bitcoin is Bitcoin. And so, yeah, trade, I can substantiate that being, or money, I can substantiate that being an art because it's the art of trade and all of that stuff. And so Polelo is just me trying to develop a podcasting site or a podcasting platform and it's not just podcasting, but everything spoken audio has a home, you know, and I'm going to start
like a SoundCloud for spoken audio.
How do you translate radio to the digital space? And I think I'm of the personal opinion that all the other podcasting platforms are doing it wrong, because they still approach it as a studio type of setup, you know. But it's not doing what YouTube has done for video, and I think the best thing about YouTube that we usually don't talk about is the first video that was uploaded to YouTube, which is A Day at the Zoo by one of the founders, and that took away video from studios and put it in the hands of people. And if you look at the video content that's getting produced today, TikTok, what used to be Vine, you know, what else, Instagram, Trends, the whole Don't Rush, blah, blah, blah. All these things are happening because YouTube took away video from studio. It took away video from compilations where people would send their videotape things to show me the funniest stuff like that. And people can actually make whatever content they can think about, and it finds a home on the internet. And all of those things end up on YouTube. I don't care which platform. TikTok ends up on YouTube. Instagram Lives end up on YouTube. Twitter videos end up on YouTube because it's the bar. If your video has made it, it's going to end up on YouTube. And I think it's about time someone does that for audio, spoken audio specifically. Yeah, I don't want music on the platform because also I don't want to deal with a lot of copyright stuff that the record labels are coming. So I'd like to see more people creating their own content and exploring what you can actually do with audio, like thrillers, man. Like someone tell you a story and you actually stay scared from the audio. Someone having sound, you know, sound design. What can sound designers do with audio content? Beatboxes. Can someone beatbox and actually make audio content like that? So yeah, I'm just exploring that, and obviously podcasts are the root of the content, but I would probably explore more wilder content as time goes on and as more people are able to adopt the platform and as I add more features that actually help people share their content and actually connect with their audiences.
All right. Oh, that's wow. That's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. So really good points. Yeah. I totally agree that there hasn't been a focus on doing what really hit me is when you said that video or the whole democratization of these platforms is meant to put power back into the hands of you know the individual creator. And you're so right, looking at the whole podcast game and how people rush to whatever electronic store it is to set up a whole podcasting studio, and it's really recreating the whole scenario with the TV studios and so yeah, that's mm-hmm. a really good point. And yeah, that you could do as I understand it, you could literally like create a voice note and then upload it
to that Carillo. That's where I like to log in and find someone's voice note on the platform. And weird enough, I keep seeing voice notes going viral on Twitter. And I'm like, come on, guys, get with the program. Post this on Twitter. So that is a dream right there.
Okay, cool. No, I'll check it out. I'll definitely check it out, man.
All right. No, man, thank you very much for having this discussion. I'll probably set up another podcast specifically for Bitcoin stuff. We can have these conversations more often and talk about shaping the environment for us in Africa, right? There's one thing I'd like to do is actually add Bitcoin payments on the Polelo website so that content creators can accept tips and stuff like that, Lightning Network and stuff like that. So
I'm definitely down for that.
Now I think we should collaborate more, man. You're a software developer, I'm a software developer, we have similar ideas, and we could just see what kind of things you can push out.
Definitely, let's keep the conversation going. Off the podcast, we follow each other, so yeah. Okay. Definitely
cool. And enjoy your day. I think I'm gonna cut the recording here.
All right, you too.
Hello.